Hello and welcome to the last episode in this season of Somerset Stories, the podcast which explores the lives of the people who live, work and create in Somerset. My name's Lewis Webb and I've been lucky enough to spend the last 14 weeks sharing the stories of some of the inspiring, creative and successful individuals and families that make this beautiful county their home. Thank you once again for listening and for your feedback and encouragement throughout the season. It really means a lot to know that we're bringing a smile to people during this time. In a change from our anticipated last episode, my guest this week is Ash Sinfield, who, together with her husband Nick, co-founded Teals, a brand new food and sustainability destination that is inspired by their time spent in Africa, where local farmers would share crates of fruit, bread and juices at farm stalls. With its location just off the A303, Ash wants to bring that same sense of wonder and hospitality to those living in Somerset, as well as those just passing through. Ash, welcome to Somerset Stories.
Thank you for having me.
You're joining us for the final episode of our second season, which is going to be published the day before Valentine's Day. You run Teals together with your husband, Nick. How did the two of you meet?
So we met at this really ridiculous event that used to happen in Bath called the 10 to 100 Ball. And I don't know whether it's still going or not, but it was this institution when we were kids growing up where it would happen once a year and you would go with your parents. And the idea is that anyone between the ages of 10 to 100 could go. And you had to go to ballroom dancing lessons for about 6 weeks before the night of the ball to learn how to dance, kind of, you know, ballroom dancing, which when I was about sort of 14 was a really good idea. And I met him at that, which sounds really corny and weird and old fashioned. But I do remember I caught him minesweeping the glasses around the side of the ballroom. It used to be held in Bath, and actually the building that it was held in has now been turned into sort of theatre space.
Did you get to see his dancing skills?
You know what? I don't really remember that. I don't remember seeing him on the dance floor at all. You were sort of forced to dance with like old men and stuff and Scottish reel. And it was all a bit of a weird thing. But our parents seemed to think that it was really fun. So, yeah, we got dragged along. And then we were at different schools and I don't think we saw each other again for a couple of years. But yeah, I remember that was the first time I met him.
Do you normally celebrate Valentine's Day? Are you romantics at heart?
Normally, we've been married for quite a long time. And normally on Valentine's Day, we just end up cooking supper because we've got three children. And I don't know, I sort of feel a bit like it's a bit corny to go out for dinner. So we just kind of cook supper at home. It's not really romantic, but it's nice. We all celebrate it.
As a couple, what characteristics do you rely on in each other as you run the business together? And I'm aware that you're only going to give your side of the picture on this one.
Nick is very determined. He's really good at dealing with people, really good at dealing with customers, and we're also really good at managing staff. And then my background is marketing and brand and, customer experience. So, yeah, we sort of split it that way.
You've spent most of your life in the Bath and Somerset area. Where exactly did you grow up? Was it in Bath itself?
We both grew up in Bath. We were both born in Africa, weirdly, within about a week of each other, but different parts of Africa. And then, both grew up in Bath because our parents kind of came back separately when we were both about six. So, yeah, grew up in and around Bath.
What were you like at school? What kind of group did you fit into?
God, I was thinking about this earlier and I can't really remember. I was quite diligent and didn't really kind of do anything particularly challenging. I kind of worked hard at school and just kind of got on with it. You know, I had naughty siblings. I was the eldest of four and they were always up to no good. But I was always the kind of the good one, which is a bit dull. But yeah, that's the kind of reality.
You were at Kingswood, which of course was founded by John Wesley, the Methodist leader. Was faith and religion part of your upbringing at all?
No, not at all. No. I mean, we went to church probably once a year. My parents chose it because it was just right for me. We, weirdly, all four of us went to different schools in Bath. And it was just, they chose based on our particular ability, or, you know, how, like, my brother was really, really bright and he went to Kingswood. One of my sisters, really dyslexic, she went to the Royal High. And then another one of my sisters went to a completely different school. And she, again, a bit like me, really kind of middle of the road, quite diligent. So, yeah, we were all over the place.
What did you want to be? Did you have any particular career aspirations while you were growing up?
You know, I went and read equine science at university, thinking that that was going to be a really good idea. And I'd then go on to become a bloodstock agent. But I quickly realised after 4 years that it was a kind of real case of the more you know, the more you don't know. You realise you don't know. And then I ended up sort of finishing university, going to London and doing completely different. I went into TV. So, yeah, that plan didn't really kind of work out the way I intended. I just didn't really know, you know. I did my A-levels and I went away for a year out traveling, and then I just kind of did what I thought I might quite like to do in the future, but it just didn't work out like that. But, you know, it often doesn't for people.
How about outside of school? What did you get up to? Were you into the music scene? Did you go to the Glastonbury Festival kind of in the 90s and that kind of thing?
No, it's funny. So we live very close to the site now, but we came to the festival quite late, both Nick and I actually. But as a teenager growing up in Bath, I used to spend quite a lot of time in the pubs and the clubs in Bath, and with my friends. Again, you know, parents quite liberal. We just sort of came and went as we pleased. And then I was massively into riding. And so we had horses at home. And so I would spend, you know, all weekend sort of doing that sort of stuff. So, yeah, it was great. You know, it was a great upbringing, partying with my mates and riding horses.
After graduating, you undertook a pretty epic fundraising journey, cycling from Kenya to Cape Town. What sparked that?
I was at university near Warwick, and one day I was in Warwick town centre and I went into a secondhand bookshop and I bought one of Livingstone's diaries, like it was about £3 or something. It was a secondhand book, because I thought Nick would really enjoy reading it, and I sent it in the post to him because he was at university in Hertfordshire. And he read it, and a couple of weeks later, he kind of rang me and said, "Oh, God, I've got this really good idea. I think we should retrace Dr. David Livingstone's journeys by bike when we graduate." And I was like, "Yeah, sounds brilliant. Let's do it." And that's exactly what happened. It was just a sort of like really random.
How did you decide that it was going to be something that you turned into a bit of a fundraising opportunity?
We sort of realised that we didn't really have any money. That was like the first thing. So in order to actually get out there and get all the equipment and bikes and panniers and kit, we'd have to sort of fundraise somehow. So we sort of set about basically kind of approaching individuals in the local area that we knew were quite wealthy or might be interested in Africa. And then asking if they would sort of help. And we kind of approached Saracen Bikes and they sponsored our bikes. And then we just sort of thought, well, actually, it's really far. It's going to be massive. It's going to take us a really long time. And so we went and we approached the Royal Geographical Society and said, look, we're going to do this trip. We went up there, did a whole load of research, photocopied Livingstone's diaries that are all at the RGS. Kind of pieced together the route, which basically took sections from all of his journeys that would take us from Kenya all the way down to Cape Town. And then they sort of said, oh, will you write sort of journal entries? Because it would be really interesting and we'd really like to publish them. So we were like, okay, yeah, it sounds great. And at that point, we sort of thought, well, actually, there's an opportunity in here to raise some money for charity, which is when we chose Dorothy House Hospice.
What sort of physical preparation did you do in advance? Were you both keen mountain bikers at the time?
We didn't do anything. Sounds so bad, doesn't it? I mean, my God, 10,500 kilometers in 7 months we cycled in like scorching temperatures through Tetsi belts, like just camping in the bush, and we did absolutely no training whatsoever. We literally just got on a plane with all of our stuff, and we went and stayed in the Mara for a couple of weeks before we started, and sort of messed about with our kit. Like literally, I think we broke a couple of water purifiers in the Mara River because it was so muddy. And then we just left. So it was pretty ridiculous. I mean, it was, I think back and it was, I can't really quite understand why our parents let us go from a sort of safety point of view. It was probably not very sensible.
Well, there were fewer forms to fill out back then, weren't there?
Yeah, I mean, we didn't have anything. We literally had our bikes, a water purifier that broke. I'd gone and seen our local doctor, who was this really amazing lady who'd studied tropical medicine, and I'd basically said to her, "Look, we're doing this trip. I need to understand all of the things that I might get sick with, and I need you to tell me what the symptoms and cure are for them." And I wrote it all in a little book, hand wrote it all in a little book. And then she prescribed me loads of medicine, which is probably really illegal. And I put all of that in my bag. And then we just kind of looked after ourselves that way. Obviously, you took malaria tablets all the way down. But yeah, I mean, it was pretty Heath Robinson.
What were some of the most memorable experiences of that journey?
So we came across villages that had never seen white people before, which was pretty amazing. We met descendants of chiefs that had met Livingstone and could like tell you a story about what happened when Livingstone came to their village. There's a one particular chief called Chief Chingu, who I remember really clearly. He was really old. Like, had a squiffy eye, and he was sort of three generations in between. Yeah, I mean, it was epic. Absolutely the most amazing trip. I mean, really scary. There were a couple of times where I thought we were just dead. We got had one horrible, horrible experience on the shores of a really horrible swampy area in Zambia, a place called the Bangweolo Swamps, where basically really close to where Livingstone died. Where we were sort of cycling around the edge of the swamp on a Sunday, and there's this sort of string of villages that's really depressed, really poor, that sort of are settlements all the way around the edge of the swamps. Loads of mosquitoes, loads of malaria, which hence why what he died from. And they were all really drunk. It was a Sunday, so the women, the men, everyone had been drinking all day. And they were not very happy to see us, and we got stoned. Like, not we didn't we weren't smoking drugs. We literally got stoned, and we didn't. There was nowhere to go to camp that was safe, so we ended up finding like a mission station. We got into this sort of network of mission stations that are sort of all over the place, and they're all connected. They kind of radio each other. And basically found a mission station, and just, like, I remember standing outside the gates, just banging the gates with rocks, saying, "Go, let us in, let us in, please." Had they not let us in, I actually don't even know what would have happened, because it was pretty scary.
With you both being well travelled, did you always plan to end up back in Somerset?
No. I think there was a period of time where we thought quite long and hard about staying in Kenya. But it was one of those things where we just sort of thought, oh God, when push came to shove, it was quite risky, and we just weren't really sure. So we came back. Our families, well, Nick's parents are in South Africa, well, mother and brother, and mine are here. So yeah, we ended up sort of slightly getting cold feet and coming back.
Both yourself and Nick have had successful careers prior to starting Teals. What made you want to strike out on your own?
We basically sort of got to a point where we were just sort of, we sort of felt like there was this amazing opportunity in what happens on the UK roadside. And then there's the sort of sustainability side of the business. So there's sort of two things. So when we did that Recycling Livingston journey, and also during the time that we both lived in Africa, so whether it was in South Africa or Kenya or wherever, there's this amazing sort of network of what they call farm stalls on the sides of roads in Africa. And they're really small, and they're normally kind of wooden buildings that are very, very simple. They're literally sort of, they've got corrugated iron roofs, they've got wooden sides, and they sit on the sides of main roads, and farmers sell their produce. And it might be just really good juice, like in Ceres, for instance, like amazing fruit juice, or really good pies or jam. And they always write the name of the farm stall in paint on the top of the corrugated iron roof. And obviously when you travel in Africa, it's really long distances, and you come to know where those stops are on the road. And in the UK, obviously it's different. So we have BP stations, and we've got, you know, Esso stations, and the food offering is always the same, and it's always really unhealthy and not very inspiring. And obviously that's just the way it's developed, because we live in a developed nation. And we've always sort of said, you know, what would happen if you built like this really awesome farm stall that was massive and had all these incredible products that were Somerset based or sustainable products, and it was right next to a main road, and would give passers-by this kind of window into Somerset and all that it offers. You know, wouldn't that be wicked? Wouldn't that be amazing? And then we started thinking about sustainability, and we sort of said, what happens if you built like a sustainable building that was powered by solar, and then you only put car charging in and you didn't put fuel in, because actually fuel is, you know, not the future. And it just kind of, I don't know, it was just one of those things. We just like, you know, why don't we just challenge the norm and just build something that's fundamentally different, but it comes from those sort of that very simple African ideal that still exists. So that's a really long answer to your question, but that's basically where the idea came from.
When you first started thinking about it, did you know of anyone else in the UK who was doing anything similar?
Well, there's obviously Gloucester Services, and it kind of is, but it sort of isn't, in that it's much smaller. It's different. It's a kind of different, it's similar, but it's different. I guess I have another way of trying to describe it. Is if like a farm shop had a baby with a service station, but it was like a really gorgeous baby. That's kind of like what it would be in my head. So yeah, it's a bit of a weird one, but it's quite difficult. There isn't a word that sort of, that you can use that explains what it is so that people understand it.
Yeah, I guess because if you were to say farm shop, people think of, you know, somewhere that's generally a little bit more tucked away, not right next to the A303, and that it is more for kind of for locals rather than travellers.
Yeah.
When you started out, was it more around we want to catch people who are on the road, or was it kind of a combination of this is for the local community as well?
So there were always three customer groups, sort of when I, you know, thought about who we were going to target. So there were the travellers, the people on the road, the locals, and then what I kind of call destination visitors. So people that come from slightly further afield, but they actually come to you so that you're the destination, if you see what I mean, which is slightly different. It's a kind of like if you're going on a day out somewhere, that's them, that's that customer group.
Being, you know, you're right, you're quite close to Cadbury Castle and that kind of thing. So people who are visiting, you know, more of those sorts of locations in the area might drop by as well and kind of see what you're all about. Because we, up until recently, lived in Wincanton, and so would kind of cross that section of the A303 quite a lot and saw the building going up. And my wife and I just were sort of guessing at what it might be. So it's actually a really nice surprise to see when the sign started going up, to think, okay, that's what it is. But I think even when the signs went up, it still was a little bit unknown as to what that actually meant.
Well, that's right. And so it was kind of intentional that it was a bit ambiguous, because so when we went through the branding exercise with and came up with the brand, we challenged the agency to come up with what it was, like a word to describe it, and no one could. And so we basically sort of said, well, you know, it's going to be really difficult from a kind of marketing perspective to try and communicate what it is. So actually, if we make it slightly mysterious, then it might be more intriguing for people potentially. And it's quite funny. Someone was in the store actually the other day, and she walked in and was just like, oh my God, this place is amazing. She said that you look at the road sign and you have absolutely no idea what you're coming to until you walk in, and it's so not what you expect, which is exactly what we wanted. She said, you know, but it just doesn't, you can't tell from the signs. So yeah, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. That's kind of what's happened.
Well, you might get people who are a bit more curious.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that's what's happening. I think people are really curious. You know, a bit like you, they've been driving past for a year and they're like, what's going on? Is that a big house or what is it?
Where did the name come from?
So we have a child called Teal. Yeah, so it wasn't a kind of soppy thing. It's funny. It's just a really memorable name. You know, it's something that, and obviously it's a colour and it's a bird. And we just thought it would be a good name that people would remember.
What have been some of your favourite food and sustainability discoveries while putting the business together?
I think from a sustainability point of view, it's standing in a building when it's -5 outside, entirely powered by solar. It's absolutely remarkable. So the base load of the building, so that means all of the fridges, all of the light, all of the heating, everything in the kitchen apart from the wood-fired oven is all powered by solar. And we've got this little room, this is like control room at the back of the building, which you can see. There's like literally a panel which tells you how much electricity is being generated by the solar panels. And even on a cloudy day, obviously after dark, we have to go onto the grid, but we have a sustainable supplier. But I mean, it's just mad, you know? I mean, I literally, every day I stand there and just go, my God, how amazing. From a business point of view, you know, we set out to create a brand that's sustainable, but also really challenges the norm. And it kind of, you know, really properly feels like we've totally delivered that, which is really exciting. And then food wise, God, there's so many, you know, there's loads of really little ones that we've got in the store that are local, like the, I think the cider is one of the things that I really get really excited about, because we've got this great big table of cider and it's covered in all these really beautiful bottles. And I know exactly where every single one is made, and it's really close. Like, and we've got a couple of girls that work in the store that the King Brains that also make ciders, and they work as Saturday Girls. You know, it's just, there's loads. It's just really exciting. You kind of wander around and from cakes to biscuits to cider to amazing meat. Like the meat just comes from a place called Bagham Farm, which is down the A303. Absolutely incredible. Incredible pork and beef. So, yeah. And then an all English cheesemonger. So all of the cheese is all English. Which is really great. So you get to celebrate all of that amazing produce.
Yeah, we're in the right place for that, aren't we?
We really are. Yeah, absolutely.
So you'd been building up to opening for quite some time, getting supplier relationships ready, building the property, and then the pandemic hit. What was going through your minds in March last year?
God, you know, it was really funny, wasn't it? So we broke ground in January and we sort of thought, oh, you know, this COVID thing, it's like not going to be a big deal. It'll be fine. And then in March, we kind of realized that it really wasn't going to be fine. And I think, I don't know, it was weird. We were sort of in a bubble because we just thought, well, we've committed to start, we've got planning permission, we've got all of the suppliers in terms of the contractors lined up. The building contractors could continue to work. And so we just kept going, you know, thinking, well, it's going to be over, isn't it? You know, by the time we open, it will all be over and everything will be back to normal, not knowing that actually that was, you know, a dream. And so we just kept going and we did pretty well actually until probably middle of the summer. And then we started getting all sorts of delays and problems. So things like glass coming out of Europe wasn't coming because, you know, all the glass factories had shut. And so that put delays on. And, you know, and all of the big, so like electricity companies, you know, all of that sort of stuff started really beginning to be affected. And so, you know, we got later and later and later. And so I would say that, you know, that first lockdown, we were like, oh, this is fine, we'll just keep going. And then we got towards the end of the summer, and we were like, oh God, this is just really difficult. So yeah, really challenging. And yeah, we opened 3 months late.
I mean, 3 months doesn't feel like that much of a delay given the circumstances. So it actually feels like you've reacted pretty well to what happened last year.
Yeah, I mean, we just did the best that we could. You know, I think we've just all the way through, we've just sort of thought, well, you know, I think genuinely we just thought, oh, well, it's not going to be that bad. It's going to be okay. We just have to keep going. And then we opened 2 weeks before Christmas and had this amazing period, this sort of 2 week period of really excited customers and people coming through the doors and shopping, and then like lockdown again. And beginning of January, was again really challenging. But we just sort of thought, well, you know, we looked at completely closing not reopening until after this lockdown was over. And then we just thought, no, you know, we're able to stay open. So let's just see if we can ride it out and try and engage the local population and let people know that we're open and that, you know, it's a really lovely place to shop as an alternative to the supermarket.
So when it did finally come to opening, did you have any first day nerves about it being such an uncertain time, or, you know, are people going to come?
Yeah, completely. You know, I was just like, I remember saying to Nick, oh my God, you know, it's a bit like throwing a party. You know, what happens if no one comes? This is going to be so bad. You know, if like no one comes through the door. But, you know, people came and, you know, and there's this kind of, I don't know, the building, people love it, you know. They walk through the door and they just kind of go, oh my gosh, wow, this is just like not, I think I said to you earlier, it's not what I expected. It feels as if people have kind of gone away, told some friends, come back, and their friends have come, and it sort of kind of grows. It's every week the same thing is happening and more people are telling more and more people, and it's really lovely.
What have been your sort of biggest successes since opening? I know you've had a little bit of time in local media, I think, and some award nominations.
Yeah, we had a really amazing piece written by the Blackmore Vale magazine, double page spread, literally in that January period, which was so valuable because it was exactly what we needed at that particular point, just to sort of like reach that wider audience and let people know that we were open. I was incredibly grateful for that. And then, yes, we've been shortlisted. So we haven't actually won anything, but yeah, we've been shortlisted for a Farm Shop and Deli Award, which we'll find out about in, I think it's June. So that's really exciting. It's a good news story in what is a kind of pretty bleak period of time for many people. So from that point of view, you know, I think people have kind of picked up on it.
You mentioned your children as well. How have you coped with that extra dimension of having them around a little bit more?
You know, they're so brilliant. So that we've got three kids, a 16-year-old daughter and then 13-year-old identical twin boys. And they've been great. You know, they sort of muck in. When we were building the store, they would come and help at weekends. So they've been really involved. And I think they understand, you know, I think it's given them something else to sort of think about during this period where everyone's been locked away. So it's not been bad for them. And then the boys have been taking turns doing washing up at the weekends when it gets busy. So, you know, it's good. It's good.
Some good life learnings for them, I think.
Yeah, I think so. It's important for them to understand, you know, it's difficult. But, you know, hard work is hopefully will pay off.
What's on the radar for Teals in the coming year?
We're basically kind of broadening out. So we started with the food market. We've got the butchery. We've got the cheesemonger. And in the last couple of weeks, we've tested out a few things and we've decided to kind of broaden out the deli, which is really exciting. So we've also been, the kitchen have been kind of playing with ideas for ready meals, as well as doing all of the takeaway stuff. So I guess one kind of benefit of being in this lockdown period with lower footfall is that, you know, there have been opportunities to test things and sort of see what works, what doesn't work, and get ready for potentially when things reopen. So hopefully we'll be sort of actually kind of robust enough in all of the things that have to happen in the store, because you've effectively got 4 or 5 different businesses kind of all sitting in one space. So it's quite complicated. There's a lot of stock and kind of moving parts. But so it's given us a good period to sort of get everyone bedded in and trained up and organised.
Ash, we're now going to play for the very last time in this season, Somerset location or Victorian novel character, which is the game where you have to guess whether names that I give you are places in Somerset or characters from a Victorian novel. How do you feel about that concept?
Well, I think I'm going to give it a go, but I'm pretty sure I'm not okay. Going to do particularly well, okay. But let's try.
All right. Well, so you've got 8 to go through. Your first name is Harcourt Tallboys.
So I would say that is a place in Somerset.
Harcourt Tallboys is a character.
Oh!
From the novel Lady Audley's Secret by Mary Elizabeth Braddon.
Okay.
Sorry.
Okay.
All right. Next one. Your next name is Thorn Falcon.
Somerset.
It is in Somerset. Yes. It's near Taunton. It's off the mark.
Yeah.
You can't get zero now.
It's okay. So I can't get zero. Yeah, exactly.
Your next name is Littley Bridge.
I don't recognise that at all. So I would say a character.
Littley Bridge is in Somerset.
Oh, God.
It's near Wells.
It's in Wells. I should have known that. Okay. Haven't been there.
Right. Your next name is Totty Poyser.
Got to be a character.
It is a character. From Anthony Trollope's The Warden.
Okay.
So that's 2. Your next name is Cold Nose.
Is that a place? Maybe. I don't.
It is a place.
Yeah. Near Wedmore. I've never again.
Yeah, Cold Nose. It is actually just a very small road near Wedmore.
Oh, so it's not a village.
Yeah, it's not a village. It's even more, you know,
obscure.
Even more cryptic than that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. So that's 3 for you. Your next name is Pleasant Riderhood.
I'd say that's a character.
It is a character.
Yes.
From the novel Our Mutual Friend by Charles Dickens. All right, 2 more to go. And you've got 4 so far.
Okay.
Tom Towers.
I'd say that's a character as well.
It is a character.
Yes.
Okay, so Tom Towers is from Adam Bede by George Eliot. I've mixed 2 of these up. So for any literature buffs out there, I apologise. Tom Towers is from Anthony Trollope's The Warden, and Totty Poyser is from George Eliot's Adam Bede. Not that anyone cares.
No, well, I was going to say, I didn't know. I'm guessing.
I don't want any Victorian novel buffs to get in touch and tell me that I got it wrong. So that's a correction, sorry. You got that one right, didn't you?
Yeah, I know,
yeah,
amazingly.
So five, okay. Yeah. Your last one is Kingston Seymour.
That's a place.
It is a place. Kingston Seymour is, so it's between, a bit north. It's still in Somerset, but it's a bit north. It's between Clevedon and Weston-super-Mare. So you got six.
Yay. That wasn't so bad. That's
congratulations.
Good. Thank you.
Yeah. Ash, where can people find more about Teals, either, you know, on social media, on the web, if they want to come and see you physically?
So we're on Instagram, Teals underscore store. You'll find us on Instagram, or if you want to come and visit, you'll find us at the North South Cadbury Junction of the A303. And then the website is just teals.co.uk. So very easy to remember, short.
Ash, thank you so much for your time and for giving up your Friday evening to have a chat with Somerset Stories.
That's a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me. It's really nice.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Somerset Stories. You can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you'd like to get in touch, you can find us on Instagram at Somerset Stories or email hello@somersetstories.com. See you next time.